episode 1231, The Pope and AI.
That's right. It's a long time coming, but I've been looking forward to this episode. I'm Matt Edison.
I'm Ben DiVona. We're back. Yeah, this is actually something that, and obviously we still haven't figured out the music yet, that in a way we've been waiting for since Pope Leo announced his papal name. And I'll explain why. Long-term listeners or people who are paying attention to inside Catholic baseball will understand what I'm getting at there. But I'll explain for everybody else who maybe has forgotten when we talked about his election a year ago. But I actually had a great idea here, Matt, that I forgot to talk to you about before we began recording. Okay. So, as you know, we're a little bit pressed for time tonight. We're recording remotely. I've had some stuff going on and all of that. So we haven't, this is going on the free feed. I actually think we can double up.
Okay.
Here's what we're going to do. If you're okay with it, we're going to record the episode, and that's for everybody. And then I guess not after the music, cause we're not doing music these days, but after the credits, then for the Patreon feed only, I'm going to weigh in and give some update on current AI events as a little chaser after the episode. So everybody gets the encyclical talk, but only on Patreon are you going to hear my thoughts and analysis on of what's been a very wild last month and a half on the AI frontier.
Perfect. So let me just plug that. Listeners, you can go to that at patreon.com/thescifichristian. We've got tons of content there. I mean, we've been doing it now for, I think, 8 years. So, yeah, lots of Patreon feed. I'll leave it there and let Ben get to it.
Okay. So let's get into this a little bit and let's maybe start with, you had said, I have to teach you how to say that word, encyclical. So what is an encyclical? Let's start there. And then I'll get back to my little teaser about how we knew that this specific encyclical was coming really since the moment we found out what name, Leo the 14th was taking. So an encyclical is, it's a letter. It's a pastoral letter from the Pope to the Church. Now, there's some other Christian denominations that will use it. Sometimes the Orthodox have used it, sometimes Anglicans, but it's primarily a Catholic thing. So the Pope will write an encyclical, and what it is a, like I said, a pastoral letter where the Pope is weighing in on an issue that is relevant to the world, to the Church at the moment, and providing pastoral teaching on that for the Church. You can think of it a little bit, and I'm saying this from a concept, not from a level of authority, okay? But you can think of it similar to what Paul was doing with his letters in the New Testament. Okay, so it's that type of a concept where, you know, you're writing a letter to the church on a pastoral topic. Okay, so encyclicals have a, you know, this type of letter has a long history throughout Christianity. More recently, our modern version of an encyclical is about 400, 500 years old that popes have been doing this. And every pope since then, well, maybe not Pope John Paul I, who lasted a month. He probably didn't get one out before he kicked the bucket. But every other pope, they write a variety of encyclicals. Sometimes a great many, sometimes just a handful, but every pope, encyclicals are a major part of their pastoral teaching throughout the papacy. Okay, so how did we know that Leo the 14th was going to be writing an encyclical on AI in particular? Well, we knew because when he took this name, he was signaling continuity with our previous Pope Leo, Pope Leo the 13th. Pope Leo the 13th wrote one of the most important encyclicals in the modern era called Rerum Novarum. And what Rerum Novarum was seeking to address was the rights and duties of workers and what Catholic social teaching has to say in light of the Industrial Revolution. Okay, and it's a very powerful encyclical, and it laid out, and Pope Leo, current Pope Leo, goes through this quite a bit in the current encyclical, which is called Magnifica Humanitas. They all have Latin names. This one stands for, you know, it's translated as Magnificent Humanity. You might say, whoa, that feels a little humanistic. Just hang on, we'll get there for the content in here. So Rerum Novarum, it goes through and it says, okay, we have the Industrial Revolution. This is changing society. What does that mean for workers? And what Leo XIII did is he laid the groundwork for modern Catholic social teaching, which rejected the dual errors of just runaway robber baron style capitalism on the one hand and socialism on the other. And it said the church rejects both of those. And it came up with a series of foundational concepts. They weren't all quite expressed this way in Rerum Novarum, but the primary ones you'll hear Catholics talk about are subsistence and subsidiarity. Subsistence being what we would say an interest in the common good, an investment in the common good. In other words, the church is not, and society is not just a collection of individuals. It is a society of people who are mutually invested, and we need to care for one another, especially the poor and the most needy among us. And then subsidiarity says, but things need to be done at the most local level possible, starting with the family. So in other words, the government should only be doing the things that the family cannot. The state government should only be doing what the local government should not, and so on and so forth. So you can see there, how does Leo XIII arrive at this foundation that rejects both budding socialism? He's writing this at the end of the 19th century. So, you know, a couple decades before the communist revolution in Russia. But these ideas are well underway. Marx is gaining steam, all of this. And so how did he get there? Because socialism absolutely contradicts the idea of subsidiarity. And then this sort of robber baron style, you know, Dickensian waif, everybody in factories and coal mines getting black lungs at age 7 style capitalism is a rejection of the idea of subsidiarity. So, solidarity. And so that's how, Pope Leo XIII lays that out. Okay, so at his election last year, Pope Leo XIV, by taking this name, is signaling, and I think he even said it explicitly in an interview, that he wanted to, in the same way Leo XIII addressed the challenges of the Industrial Revolution, seek to do the same thing with the technological and AI revolution. So we've been waiting for this for a year. And so it came out, and he released it on May 15th, which is the, I think, 130th, or I forget exactly what year Rerum Novarum was released, but it was the anniversary, is the same day that Rerum Novarum was released by Pope Leo XIII, so very, very much intentional. And, of course, it's generating all sorts of press. Now, unlike a lot of people who are writing about this and forming all sorts of opinions about it, I've actually read it. So that's actually very helpful. So I'm going to, what I want to do is actually walk you through this and hopefully get a little bit deeper than the headlines. There's a lot of big, you know, thoughts and opinions out there by people who I suspect have not read it. In fact, at best, maybe they had ChatGPT summarize it for them. Oh, the irony. So let me give a couple of overall thoughts as we get in. I think that, first of all of us are going to be guilty. We're even guilty 2 seconds ago when we titled this episode of equating this encyclical as the AI encyclical. That's a mistake. When you actually read the thing, yes, Pope Leo talks a lot about AI, but he also does something that's very, very wise, which is that he recognizes that any type of an attempt to define AI and put a definition around it is a loser's game, because that definition is very slippery. It's a very broad definition, and it's changing all the time. It's better to think about this is an encyclical that is about humanity's relationship to technology in the modern age. So we need to think about it much more broadly than that. And if we're going to get out of it what he has in here, we need to have that perspective going in. I do want to encourage people to read it. I would say, and I'm not going to go through it, this is not a book review, but if I have a critique of the encyclical, and it's a critique of a lot of contemporary magisterial writing, which is that it is too long. And I think that's a bit unfortunate, because it raises the likelihood that people will not actually read this and just rely on the summaries of it. And I think especially for Catholics, it's worth your time to read it. The reason I say it's too long, because if you just pick it up and it's like you pick up the ebook or whatever, you're gonna be like, this isn't that long of a book. But remember, this is a letter. It's not a book. And the gap between those in modern encyclicals is getting too fuzzy. By contrast, if you go back and read Rerum Novarum, you can plow your way through Rerum Novarum very quickly. This is five times as long. Rerum Novarum is about 10,000 words. This is about 50,000 words. Okay, so I think that that's a little bit unfortunate and raises a bit of a barrier to entry as we go. But nevertheless, I'm for those of you who probably aren't going to read it, which I recognize as most of you, I'm actually going to get us into the text. This is like a little mini flash deep dive, if you will, not quite at that level. But I'm going to quote fairly extensively from this encyclical as we go. As I'm quoting, one thing to note that will be helpful if you want to go back and reference any of this. Encyclicals, and indeed most modern magisterial writing, is divided into paragraphs. So you'll have, like, every paragraph is numbered throughout it. So as we go, I'm going to be referencing paragraph numbers as we go. If you pull up the text of the encyclical, you'll see immediately what I'm talking about. Okay, so that'll, you know, rather than page numbers or whatever, that's your reference point for where I am in the text. Okay, so what I want to do here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We're going to go through six sections that are going to have a few quotes in them, and not necessarily linear sections, but topics throughout there. But I think the best place to start is where the Pope starts, which is that the overall controlling image that he gives for this encyclical. He has a visual image he wants us to keep in mind that he sets out from the very beginning. And it's he contrasts the building of the Tower of Babel to the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem by Nehemiah after the exiles returned. And it's really easy to see where he's going with that. Right? It's like this idea that you can use the same type of construction tools for this to try and overthrow God and play God yourself, which is what the Tower of Babel was really in a nutshell, or you can use it in service of God, in obedience to God for the building of God's kingdom. That's this fundamental thing he pulls out. Now, to the Pope's credit, he actually does something very smart here. Because, well, it would be tempting to hear that imagery and say, well, he's saying the tech itself is neutral. He is at length to say the tech is not neutral. The tech is never neutral because we are never neutral when we use it, and it is never neutral when it is created. So this isn't quite as simplistic as a hammer is a hammer, and it's just a matter of what you're swinging it for. Pope Leo recognizes AI is more complicated than that. The bigger point, rather than just a simplistic, the tech is neutral, doesn't matter, just it's all about how you use it. The bigger point to take out of this, I think, is that Pope Leo is constructing that our use of any technology, and again, this is where, yes, we're going to talk about AI, but this is a lot broader than AI, that point needs to come in because this applies to every piece of technology, not just AI, is that we have to ask ourselves, where does our usage of it fit within the hierarchy of virtues? Okay, so when you talk about a hierarchy of virtues, this is a point Chesterton makes very, very well in his writing, that the real problem with the world is not a lack of virtue, it's that the virtues are just like somebody shuffled the deck. In other words, like hierarchy of virtues, really simple way to illustrate this that you've probably heard in 1,000 sermons is, you know, God, your spouse, your kids, you know, your job, whatever. Like there's a hierarchy of loyalties and loves that we have in our life. And so it is right to love your children. It is not right to love your children more than God, right? It is right to love your work and to seek to do well there. It is not right to love your work more than your spouse, you know? And so right there, there's a hierarchy of virtues. And one of the things that we find in our world is that when the hierarchy goes wrong, when the hierarchy goes wrong, things that used to be virtues become vices. And Pope Leo starts to point out a lot of these as we go when he starts talking about AI, and we'll see some of them as we go. In other words, and it's not too hard to see examples of this if you think about AI and the conversation that's taking place around it. We want to create a post-scarcity society. Okay, like in isolation, that's fine. But where does that fit in the hierarchy of virtues? One way, and I'm not suggesting that even our most nefarious tech pros are suggesting this, but one way to create a post-scarcity society would be to kill everyone, right? Like, obviously, that's your hierarchy of virtues would be out of whack. But what about when it comes to building 2 trillion data centers and destroying neighborhoods and you know, natural resources? Like, where does the hierarchy of virtues come in there? Like, doesn't mean we're absolutely against data centers, full stop, but there is a hierarchy of virtues that needs to be in play. There needs to be a hierarchy of virtues in how we think about the technology, and I'll hold my fire on that as we get in. Okay, so Babel versus Jerusalem. That's the controlling image in here. All right, so let's start with what's been one of the more misquoted sections of this encyclical, which is where Pope Leo talks about the need to disarm AI. And he uses those words. I want to disarm AI. And, you know, when I saw that before I read the encyclical, of course, I got very excited. It's like, yeah, I've been calling for the Butlerian jihad, and here we go. That is, you know, this is why he's the Pope and I'm not, because his point is actually, well, one of many reasons, but his Pope is, he's the Pope. The Pope's point is actually a lot more subtle and nuanced and thoughtful than that. We'll get to that quote in just a second in paragraph 110, but I want to first quote from what he says in paragraph 107 on this topic of what does he actually mean by disarming AI. The crux of it is AI cannot replace humans. So there's our first hierarchy of virtues. If we see AI as a replacement of humanity, things have gone wrong. So paragraph 107. We cannot be satisfied with merely calling for the moralization of machines, the so-called alignment of AI with human values, without also having the courage to insist on a further condition, the possibility of openly discussing the ethical frameworks involved and subjecting them to shared standards of social justice. Otherwise, those who control AI will impose their own moral vision, which will become the invisible infrastructure of these systems. A more moral AI is not enough if that morality is determined by a few. In other words, if the alignment problem is solved in the image of Sam Altman, we haven't actually solved the alignment problem. The alignment problem, for those who aren't up on, like me and Leo over here on your AI shorthand, the alignment problem is how do you develop AI in a way that doesn't destroy humanity? Like, we're all really, whether you're familiar with the alignment problem, all of us are very invested in getting that right. But if we're aligned, what Pope Leo is saying is it's not enough just to solve that. There needs to be further than that, because we can't just have it's aligned to Sam Altman's interests or Elon Musk's interests or Bill Gates or whoever. And I know Bill Gates is just a grouchy old so-and-so on the sidelines these days, but nevertheless. Okay, so that a couple paragraphs later then, with that thought in mind, we get to paragraph 110, which is our famous disarming quote. So he says, finally, I would like to employ the expression to disarm, which is close to my heart. This is where I kind of sat up. Here we go. Disarming AI means freeing it from the mentality of armed competition, which today is not limited simply to the military context, but is also an economic and cognitive phenomenon. This race entails a race for ever more powerful algorithms and larger data sets driven by the desire to secure geopolitical or commercial dominance. To disarm means discrediting the assumption that technical power automatically confers the right to govern. To disarm does not mean rejecting technology, but preventing it from dominating humanity. It means freeing technology from monopolistic control and opening it to discussion and debate, therefore making it human-friendly and restoring it to the plurality of human cultures and the way of life. Absolutely brilliant. Okay? So what he's saying is, and this is correct, from, you know, the church's position is not this technology is okay, that one's not. This AI model is fine, that one's not. He's doing an end run around that whole conversation and saying, disarm it. If your goal with the technology is geopolitical dominance or commercial dominance or economic dominance, that is not okay. To disarm does not mean rejecting technology, but preventing it from dominating humanity. This is also to go back to the point that this is less about AI, and you know, apply that to any technology in your life. Like, we've talked about the impact of cell phones on on ourselves. Okay? Does your cell phone, whether it has AI on it or not, dominate your life? Well, according to the Pope, you need to disarm it at that point. It has, your hierarchy of values has gotten flipped. You can keep the technology, but if you don't disarm it, if you don't get the hierarchy of values right, you've actually screwed up. Okay. The next one here, and we're going to go start actually quite a ways at the beginning, and then we'll, he comes back to this theme. This is paragraph 12 in the intro, and then we'll get to a couple later on. His second point, or at least the second point I'm going to call out, and I really like this one. Human limitations are not an error to be corrected. Oh, that's really, really brilliant. Okay, let's listen to what he says. So, paragraph 12. Secondly, building for the common good, there's your Catholic social teaching lingo going all the way back to Leo XIII, means accepting the limits and weaknesses of humanity without considering them an error to be corrected. Today, the human desire for fullness of life is at risk of being misled by deceitful goals, such as the prospect of a technology that promises to free us from all weaknesses and models of well-being that leave behind entire populations. All too often, we place our hope in unlimited upgrades, upgrades is in scare quotes, which is wonderful, in forms of progress that exacerbate inequalities and in immediate solutions incapable of healing people's wounds. As a result, while some pursue the illusion of unlimited self-assertion, many are deprived of basic necessities. Okay, so that's a nice shot across the bow. We're going to come back to that. Let me just get to where we're going to come back to that in paragraph 118. So I want to keep going here and let him build on it. Our relationship with life seems to be in crisis today. Everything that appears as a limit, incapacity, illness, old age, suffering, vulnerability, tends to be seen primarily as a defect to be corrected, rather than as a reality through which our humanity matures and opens itself to relationship. And yet we must remember that humanity flourishes not despite limitations, but often through them. The light of faith offers a perspective on reality that helps us recognize what we call the contingency of the things of this world. While it is right to strive to alleviate the suffering that marks human life, it is also wise to acknowledge our fundamental finitude, knowing that religious experience, and in particular Christian faith, propose that we live without oversimplification the ambivalence between human greatness and limitation, interpreting it in the light of our original and fundamental relationship with God. This is one that's very near and dear to my heart at the moment, for a couple of reasons. First of all, limitations are actually a feature, not a bug, in humanity. I'm reading one of these annoying nonfiction books where like the first chapter summarizes the whole thing and then the rest of it's just fluff. And I knew I was making that mistake, but I love the topic so much that I made it anyway, and it's almost worth it. It's still really bugging me, but the book is called Inside the Box. And it's essentially about this concept about how limits create freedom, limits build creativity, not the other way around. And we've talked about this a little bit, like in the form of, you know, poetry, like Shakespeare's sonnets are all very rigid. We're wrapping up here in the next couple months this deep dive on the Divine Comedy, and the Divine Comedy may be the greatest work of literature of all time, or at least top five, and it's a rigid format as he's going, even more so in the original Italian than we get in the English because of its terza rima rhyming structure. And you find that limitations are actually what bring the greatest things out from us. And so Pope Leo is correct that we should be suspicious of anything, especially technology, that seeks to look at limits and say, let's get rid of those. Those are the problem. But there's actually a much darker side to this. And you see it with the rise of eugenics in our north of the border here in Canada, most notably. But you also see it in our country. So, I didn't necessarily plan to get into this, but I'm going to get into this just a little bit here as a bit of a sidebar. But the reason we're delayed right now with recording new episodes is my 3-month-old son just had open heart surgery, and he's fine. Like, he came home from the hospital, so everything's good. But the reason he had open heart surgery is that he has Down syndrome, and we live in a time right now, and it was very prominent in this social media YouTuber story from this last week, where people regard Down syndrome as a bug to be eliminated rather than something that God has given to us for, you know, either our building up of our suffering or just, you know, one of the things of this world, but is not something that needs to be eradicated. We look at that and we say we need to cure it. And, you know, this YouTube couple that killed their baby, I have two reactions to them. Like, number one, I think they are very rightly being called out and condemned for this horrible action. I also have sympathy for them, and I'll tell you why. Because when you get the call that your baby has Down syndrome, like they do the in utero test, and you're told there's a high probability your baby's going to have Down syndrome, the very first thing you are asked by the nurse is, do you want to abort? And so you live in a culture, like, it's not, here's some resources for you, here's what this means. It's, let us know if you'd like to kill your child. Okay? So we live in a culture that says people with Down syndrome are, as it was described in that guy's tweet, a glitch. And that's exactly what Pope Leo is addressing here. And like the danger of AI, one of the dangers of AI is that it feeds into that and says human weakness, human limitation, that's a problem. Let's overcome it. Let's rise above that. And the church says, in the voice of the Holy Father here, no, the opposite is true. And he's going to go even further in paragraph 120. Where he says, to eliminate suffering entirely would mean, in the end, extinguishing love and desire as well. Those who love and desire cannot avoid passing through trial and suffering, and over the years we carry within us lessons that leave the mark like scars, the memory of a journey shaped by freedom and failure, dreams and disappointments. It is only thanks to the interplay of these elements that the wonders of the soul occur within us, allowing us the sense of richness of our humanity. To renounce this adventure, both tragic and splendid, in the name of presumed transcendence of all limits could mean many things, but it would no longer be human. Like, you could just end the encyclical right there. Like, that's just a, you know, a mic drop moment. And so, you know, again, I go back to my dual reaction to that couple. Like, they are rightly being called out. And I don't mean people who are sending them death threats. Okay, obviously I don't mean that. But people who are saying to them, no, what you did was evil. And you should not do that. That is wrong. That is correct. That is holy. They should hear that condemnation of their actions. But I'm also sympathetic because they are indicative of a generation, multiple generations now, that has been fed on the lie that the goal of life is to be happy, to eliminate suffering, to just make things, you know, easy and smooth sailing. And that's simply not the case. The church teaches us something else. And I love that. To renounce that would be many things, but it would no longer be human. All right. Building on that, the Pope tells us that humanity is more than intelligence. This is actually a really key point, because the way that the whole conversation is being framed around AI is that AI and humans are competitors, especially when we start talking about, like, job loss and the economic impact. The Pope will talk about that in a minute. But that's actually a flaw. And in fact, let's actually go further than that. One of the things that you hear in a lot of the AI discussion is how much better AI is than humans at all of this stuff. Like, it can, you know, whether it's math, whether it's, you know, it can pass the bar exam. Can you pass the bar exam? I can't pass the bar exam. You know, AI can pass the bar exam. Look at how good it is. And the Pope wants to tell us that, no, that's actually flawed. And if you think about it, that actually makes a lot of sense. Like, a dumb calculator, you know, the type accountants have on their desk, not one on your phone, can calculate much faster than 99.999% of humanity. That doesn't make it more human. It makes it better at calculating. And we understood that. But with AI especially, we seem to be forgetting that. So he says in paragraph 99, It is not possible to provide a single comprehensive definition of AI. What can be stated, however, is that we must avoid the misconception of equating this type of intelligence with that of human beings. These systems merely imitate certain functions of human intelligence. In doing so, they often surpass human intelligence in speed and computational capacity, offering tangible benefits across many fields. Yet this power remains entirely tied to data processing. So-called artificial intelligences do not undergo experiences, do not possess a body, do not feel joy or pain, do not mature through relationships, and do not know from within what love, work, friendship, or responsibility mean. Nor do they have a moral conscience, since they do not judge good and evil, grasp the ultimate meaning of situations, or bear responsibility for consequences. They may imitate language, behavior, and analytical skills, or even simulate empathy and understanding, but they do not understand what they produce, for they lack the effective relational and spiritual perspective through which human beings grow in wisdom. Ladies and gentlemen, that is your first magisterial announcement in Catholic history, on whether or not machines have souls. They do not. They are not made in the image of God. And it's actually a really important point. Like, when we think about, oh, you're made in the image of God, like, what does that actually mean? Well, it's a big question. But it certainly means that you're more than just your ability to figure things out. You're more than just your ability to compute. Okay, so he goes on with this in paragraph 113. In reality, elevating any single dimension of human existence to an absolute is always a mistake. Indeed, disorder does not arise only from scarcity. Even unchecked growth can give rise to impoverishment. In an ecosystem, balance is disrupted when one species expands at the expense of another. In human life, something similar occurs when one faculty claims to be the measure of everything. Thus, intelligence, when absolutized, overshadows other essential dimensions of life, such as affection, the will, commitment, and relationships. Similarly, technical power, if left unbalanced, does not make us more capable, it makes us more isolated and more vulnerable to being dominated and excluded. Absolutely brilliant. Okay. My favorite part of the encyclical, though, is when he starts talking about transhumanism. Okay? So, and this is a little bit fringe, but maybe not. It's like this idea that we can use technology to sometimes biomedically to enhance ourselves to something beyond being human. At its most extreme, this would be something like uploading your consciousness into a computer. And what would that mean? So he says a couple of things for this about this. First of all, in 126, for this reason, humanity in all its grandeur and woundedness must never be replaced or surpassed. We can embrace the technological progress that alleviates suffering and unlocks new possibilities, provided that we do not abandon the very essence of our humanity, namely the capacity for relationship and love. This leads to a crucial question. If an authentic more than human exists, where is it to be found? Okay, so then this is coming at the tail end as he's been addressing this concept of transhumanism. Like, what happens if you can upload your consciousness into a computer? And he's thinking broader than that, but that's just maybe the easiest one for us to announce. He's saying, where is this, you know, concept of being more than human to be found? And you might be tempted to think the Pope's going to say, nowhere. We're human. That's it. Don't push farther than that. No, the Pope does something brilliant. Where is this to be found? The Christian faith answers that question by pointing to a fulfillment that does not rise from technological divinization, but through God's grace received in Christ. Skipping ahead to 128. When we embrace the possibility of transcending ourselves through God's grace, we do not deny our nature, nor do we become less human. On the contrary, as Pope Francis explained, we become fully human when we become more than human, when we let God bring us beyond ourselves in order to attain the fullest truth of our being. Herein lies the radical departure from Promethean dreams. What saves humanity is not enhanced self-sufficiency, but a relationship that liberates, a communion that transforms. In this Spaceflight, a technology that merely classifies and optimizes what already exists, can, however unintentionally, become an obstacle to change and growth. For an algorithm, an error is a flaw to be corrected. For a person, however, an error can be a catalyst for profound change. A person's future is not calculable, but depends on one's freedom, elevated by the inexhaustible grace of God, and on the relationships cultivated. Absolutely brilliant. Let me explain what the Pope just did. Instead of saying, don't upload your consciousness into a computer, don't become an android, don't do whatever other crazy things Silicon Valley is dreaming up to transform your body and you as a human, and just leave it at that, he says, okay, if the discussion on the table is transhumanism or posthumanism, the church would like to have a word, because we've been in that game for 2,000 years. And what that game is that the whole point of the church is to make you more than human. But not the way you guys want. You guys want it Tower of Babel style, where you ascend beyond your humanity and ascend beyond God and you do it yourself. What the church promises through the Eucharist and then through the new heaven and the new earth is something much, much deeper. It is transformation in Christ. Absolutely incredible. Okay. Last big one, and then we just have one kind of wrap up one at the end. That's quite fun. The Pope hits on then, okay, what about the possibility of this mass job displacement? What does that do for us? This is really important, and I want people to really pay attention to what he says here, because people are missing the actual issue here. When people think about what happens if AI takes all of our jobs, crashes the economy, they're thinking, like, how am I going to pay my bills? And that matters. But there's something more fundamental that also matters. Okay. 149. For these reasons, work is not simply an instrument. It expresses and enhances the dignity of our lives. It is a requirement of the human condition, a normal path toward maturity, development, and personal fulfillment. In this regard, financial assistance to the poor may at times be necessary in emergencies, but it cannot become the sole response, since the goal is to enable each person to live with dignity through his or her own work. And then just a bit later in 154... work remains a fundamental dimension of the human experience, for not only is it a means of sustenance, but it also is also a context for expression, relationships, and contributing to the community. Therefore, the problems related to work extend beyond the income necessary for family survival. A society that guarantees employment to only a small fraction of the population, despite having a high level of technical development, risks exposing many to forced inactivity, a lack of responsibility, and the absence of daily tasks and stimuli, resulting in human and cultural impoverishment. A few really key lessons there. Don't regard your work as a means to an end. I go to work because I have to, but if I didn't have to, then my life would be so much better. Be careful. Like, if you suddenly became independently rich overnight and could quit your job, your life might not be better. Why? Because your work is part of the actual act of going to work, of doing a job. And of course, there are jobs that lack human dignity, but the act in the abstract, the concept of work, is part of the dignity and growth of humanity. It's part of your dignity and growth and maturity as a person. It is how you develop yourself. I'm going to quote here from an article from the Free Press that I read this morning that actually, it's from Senator Josh Hawley, and it's perfect on the same theme. And so I don't really care what you think about Josh Hawley outside of this. These two paragraphs are perfect. So he's addressing also the concept of AI and the impact it could have on the economy. Work, in any case, is about more than wages. It is what our Puritan forebears called a vocation or calling, labor that builds a community, supports a family, and gives someone their independence. It is how a person feels like they have earned a role in society. That's not only a theological truth, it's an empirical observation. So when Bill Gates announces that AI will leave humans no longer needed for most things, he is not describing a paradise of leisure. He is describing a crisis of meaning. Silicon Valley's proposed cure of a universal basic income gets the diagnosis backward. Work is about dignity, not just dollars. Pay a man to do nothing and you have not solved his problem. You have deepened it. Instead, the government needs to understand what is happening in the job market and commit resources to helping working people adapt to it. Absolutely right. Like, absolutely right. And we need to recognize and address, and the Pope is calling us to recognize and address that part of the meaning crisis and the AI crisis and technological crisis in front of us. Now, one just quick note on that, because people will bring up, well, you know, they said the same thing when cars came out. Okay, you need to appreciate there's a fundamental difference between what's happening with AI, and those who stay after the credits may get a little bit of hope on this, so go subscribe to Patreon if you want a reason to be hopeful on this, but there's a fundamental difference between any other technology that displaces parts of the economy and AI. In fact, there's two fundamental differences. Breadth, meaning the, it's not just like, you know, the freezer came online and so the Iceman needs to find something else to do with his life. Like, that was a problem for the Iceman, but the economy can absorb that. But, you know, it's a very narrow sector. It's breadth and it's velocity. Okay? Now, we haven't felt that yet in the economy. We've gotten some rumblings, but if, you know, you arrived at the point where AI could really displace most jobs, that could happen very, very rapidly. So people need to recognize that, yes, technology has always caused job disruption, but that there are reasons to look at what's happening now and say this is fundamentally different, okay? Or at least has the potential to be so. But again, some little good news coming up after the credits. All right, so the Pope goes on with all of this, and then he wraps up by calling us to action. But he recognizes as he calls us to action that this is something that feels so much bigger than us as individuals. And so what are we supposed to do with that? Because it's like, I don't have a board seat at Anthropic. You know, I'm not in the room with Sam Altman. Like, what am I supposed to do? Well, I'm going to start reading in 2:12 and then go immediately into 2:13, because the Pope is going to offer us some advice from a wonderful source. He says, this is in 2:12, "Yet no one is without responsibility. We all have our areas, our own areas for action, and it is precisely there and nowhere else that we must choose whether to fuel the mentality of force, even if through indifference, cynicism, lies, or hatred, or to preserve the mindset of peace, with truth, moderation, closeness, and care." So everybody's responsible. 2:13, the 20th century Catholic author J.R.R. Tolkien, in the words of a protagonist in one of his novels, described our responsibility in this way. Let me pause. This is a big moment for many of us, because I believe that this is the first time in magisterial history, and granted, it's only like 70 years since the publication of Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Rings is about to be quoted in a magisterial document.
Crazy.
This is amazing.
In the future, they'll look back and be like, who is this Tolkien, this great thinker?
He says, "It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of these years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till." All right, here's your Lord of the Rings trivia. Who is talking? Who is that quote from?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking everyone, but I'll pause and let you answer, and then I'll give the answer.
My guess? It seems like something Gandalf would say.
No, that is Faramir.
Okay.
That is Faramir. All right, so there you go. Okay, so that's the encyclical. Again, it's very long. I think that I wish it was a little bit more brief, because there's a lot of good stuff in there to pull out. I would encourage people to read it. But that's a really incredible message. Now, I do think that as AI evolves, the church is going to need to continue to speak into this. This needs to be the opening of the conversation, not the end of it. But highly recommend it. And I think I, as like we've kind of gone through the last few years of conversation on AI, from it's going to kill us all to, which I still kind of believe, to, you know, recognizing this is getting very complicated. We need to think about it more in a nuanced way. The Pope's wisdom and his leadership here is something that I think everyone ought to look to, including if you're not a Catholic yet. It is absolutely brilliant.
Well, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we are the Sci-Fi Christians, and we are signing off. But go check out patreon.com/thesci-fi-christian for the conversation that continues.